Last week we talked about, we met in the church assembly area upstairs, and we talked about the whole subject of giving. I'm not going to rehash that whole situation, but we talked about giving in terms of certainly monetary giving. That's what a lot of us think about. But we also talked about giving in terms of giving of ourselves and giving of our heart, giving of our time, giving of our best abilities, giving of those things that don't cost us money but take our time and precious resource. And we talked about how God really wants us to do that to further his mission. And we talked a little bit about some of the scripture that backs that up. And so that I think today is the day we vote on the budget upstairs, so you'll have a chance to do that. Wednesday night, I was out of town, but I hope everybody who had questions got them to somebody on the committee. If you have questions, you're free to ask me about them, not during the lesson, but afterwards, and I'll give you whatever insight I have. I was not beneficiary to the Wednesday night discussion, so I'm not sure what all happened there. But we looked at commitments, and we looked at, you know, the things we have to do to be committed in life, to relationships, to be committed to jobs, to be committed to causes. And the Lord's cause is certainly worthy of commitment. We talked about that. And then the last time we met here, we talked about Revelation chapter 5. And Revelation chapter 5 was the chapter where we begin to see a lot of the emotion unfold, and we begin to see a lot of the things happen in the throne room of God. We begin to see God with a scroll in his right hand, and the angels announcing who was worthy to take the scroll and who was worthy to open the scroll, and no one came forward, and there was this long silence. And what had been a glorious chorus of archangels, of elders, of church people, of regular angels, ten thousands upon ten thousands of people that were singing "Worthy is the Lamb" and praising God and all of that, now is a very time of quiet. And so God is holding the scroll out in his right hand, actually, and no one comes. John begins to weep. And as I mentioned, that's the only time tears are in heaven. And John's just there. He's there as a viewer. He's viewing into the portal of heaven. And the angel says, "Don't weep. You know, there is one worthy." And his point, a lamb comes forward, and we understand that the word used for lamb is the word used for sacrificial lamb, not like a regular lamb. And that word is used predominantly in the New Testament, a word that means a sacrifice, God's perfect sacrifice. And so he comes forward, this lamb who has the marks of being slain, and takes the scroll out of the right hand of God. And we talked a little bit about the power of that and the imagery of that and all of the unbelievable emotion that John's going through, having been a Jew his whole life, having understood the whole purpose for their being was to be found worthy and go to heaven. And it appeared to him that no one was worthy on heaven and earth to take that scroll until the sacrificial lamb goes forward. And of course, one of the archangels says, you know, "Don't worry, the Lord is worthy." And the Lord takes the scroll, and the cheering starts. And so we end chapter 5 on that note, and we come to chapter 6, which is where we're going to start today. And I want to preface chapter 6 just with a couple of reminders. First reminder is Jews throughout time have looked at man's time on earth in two periods. One of them is called the present age. That's the age we live in now. And the other time is the age of the Lord, the golden age, the time when the Lord comes back and everything will be perfect. Now, we kind of view those ages a little differently in Christian circles. We view this as the the church age. We're in the age where the churches are beginning to rise. But nevertheless, in both of those views of the world, the separation between the world as we know it and the world to come is a set of events. And the set of events in Jewish time is called the terrible day of the Lord, or the day of the Lord, or the day of judgment. And so all of that is in John's mind as he's beginning to see in the throne room of heaven the Lamb take the scroll book. And as I mentioned, the scroll is the deed of the earth. And he's able to open those seals. There's seven seals on there. We'll begin to see them as we go today. So the day of the Lord is the terrible time when the Lord takes his wrath out upon the disobedient earth. And it's when the earth, we see it created in Genesis, and in Revelation, we see it taken apart and put back together the way the Lord wants it to be for the millennial kingdom. And we see that time beginning in this set of verses. The other thing that I want to remind you of, not mentioned in Revelation, but mentioned in Thessalonians, is the rapture has already occurred. The rapture occurs in earlier parts of between chapters 3 and 4 of Revelation. And the way we know that is we see the redeemed church in heaven. And the redeemed church in heaven is not there until the rapture takes place. Although the rapture is not mentioned specifically in Revelation, it's mentioned in Thessalonians and a few other places. The rapture has taken place. So the churches have been taken out of the world. I won't say the churches. The believers have been taken out of the world. And so now what you're left with is a world without the Holy Spirit, without the Christian influence in the world, and that's all been raptured out. And so now we begin to see God's judgment begin to take place on the earth. And so let's take a look, if we can, at how history begins to unfold in front of John. So let's take a look at chapter 6 of Revelation, and let's read verses 1 and 2. Someone want to read chapter 6, verses 1 and 2.
And I saw when the Lamb opened one of the seals, and I heard, as it were, the noise of thunder. One of the four beasts said, "Come and see." And I saw, and behold, a white horse. And he that sat on him had a bow, and a crown was given to him. And he went forth confident and conquering.
Okay, we've probably all heard of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. You may have even seen a movie on the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse 10 or 15 years ago. The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse are really this chapter of Revelation. And this talks about horses. All through history, if you look at ancient Jewish writings, there's all sorts of judgments by God visited by horsemen. Horsemen are symbolic of military and armies. And so we see the beginning of one seal is opened. I want to make one note as we go. Mine says, "I watched as the Lamb opened the first of the seven seals. Then I heard one of the four living creatures," remember, these are the seraphim that circle the throne, "say in a voice like thunder, 'Come.'" The "and see" that is in the King James Version shouldn't be there. That's a mistranslation of Greek. It should just be "come." Because "come and see" is a common Greek term. They put it in there, but this is just "come," because there's nothing for them to see. This is a call of judgment. So the angel is calling this horseman to come forward. "Come." And then John says in verse 2, "I looked, and there before me was a white horse. Its rider held a bow, and he was given a crown, and he rode out as a conqueror bent on conquest." So the first horse of the four horses here is a white horse. White horse typically is the symbol of victory. And you see in parades a lot of times, you know, generals riding white horses. And, you know, Washington rode a white horse. And it's just a military symbol of victory, victory and conquest, a white horse. And so you see this rider riding a white horse. There's been a lot of discussion about who this rider is. And we'll talk about that as we go through. But I want you not to focus on who the rider is right now, but I want you to focus on what the rider does. And because that'll give us a clue as to who the rider is. So he says, again, voice like thunder. You know, you can just imagine, if you picture this, the archangel with a voice like thunder, a loud booming voice, says, "Come out." And out comes person, a rider on a white horse. And what is he holding? A bow. If you think about not military terms today, but think about the old days. A bow, an archery bow, was the first real significant effort in military times to kill other than through hand-to-hand combat. I mean, we had cannons and things like that, but a bow, if you had archers, and you see all the old movies, the archers shoot the arrows and they come raining down, they kill hundreds of people on the other side. That was the first sign of terror because the archers would come out. So today we would probably look at missiles that way. We can fire missiles and never even see blood. You know, it just happens 100 miles away somewhere. You know, we don't have to, we just pull the trigger and it takes off. Well, an arrow was kind of their view of that in the old times. So this rider comes out carrying a bow. So he's got the ability here to wage war. So he's a mighty victor. He's coming out with a bow in his hand. We'll talk about what's missing here in a second also. And it says he was given a crown. The interesting thing here, we talked about crowns before, and there's two types of crowns. One is a royal crown, which is a crown that you get because of your position. Like a king has a royal crown. That's called a diadem. That's a sovereign crown, something that is given because of the position of being a king or a queen or conqueror or whatever. Then there's an earned crown, which we call a Stephanos, from the martyr Stephen. And that's if you do something. If you win a race, you get a crown. So it may be a crown of garlands. It may be a crown of jewels. It may be a crown of whatever it happens to be. You know, it's kind of a sign of victory, a sign of accomplishment. And so this living creature, this rider, is given a crown. And the crown here is the earned crown, not the royal crown. So it's the crown of victory or crown of conquest. And it says he rode out as a conqueror, bent on conquest. So this rider comes, and he's got a bow in his hand, which is a symbol of military conquest. He rides out as a conqueror, and he's bent on conquest. He's going out to conquer people. He's got a crown on, which indicates that he's successful at what he's doing. One thing that's missing, however, from this scene is arrows. He has a bow, but he has no arrows. Which is kind of interesting. And anybody have any ideas about what that may mean? Well, I want to set a little bit different stage here. We've talked about the tribulation period. We've talked about this in generality, and we know that's a 7-year period, and it's sort of the period that leads up to Armageddon. The rapture happens before the tribulation. You've got 3.5 years of relative peace, and then you've got all chaos the last 3.5 years. This is the signal of the start of the tribulation. This rider rides to bring nations together by his power, but through bloodless coups. He has to fight no wars to make this happen. This is something that happens by the power of the personal power of this rider who goes out. And I want to just think about it for a minute. Think about the world stage. The rapture's taken place. You've got millions of Christians have disappeared. Millions of children have disappeared. All infants have disappeared. You've got the graves opened and people have disappeared that are Christians. And the whole scenario is one of unrest. You've got a scenario where people are trying to figure out what happened. They don't know what happened. There's a lot of concern going on. Think about in this country what would happen if the Christians were raptured out of this country. However many people you think are Christians in this country, I don't know. But there's probably a significant number of people that would be raptured out. Certainly there would be a lot of splaining to do. You know, somebody would have to say something. Now in China, even if there's a large number gone, the government wouldn't have a whole lot of explaining to do because people disappear there all the time. In a lot of other countries the same way. But here, or in Europe, it would be a problem. People would have to understand. People would have to explain it away. So there'd be a lot of chaos. So picture a time here when somebody comes on the scene who's powerful, who can create peace, write treaties, do all the things that military conquests do without ever firing a shot. And what we see here is this, this is variously identified as the Antichrist, the first rider of the apocalypse. He makes his appearance known. He comes out. And remember, the Antichrist, when he first comes, is a man of peace. He deludes the world as a man of peace. You know, countries, he even signs a covenant with Israel not to destroy Israel. You know, people turn their arms over to a great one-world government. You can see seeds of that today, you know, in the United Nations and other kinds of things where people are looking for the United Nations to come in on every conflict in the world. And so you see the seeds of some of this world view coming into place. You know, if a world leader were truly respected, and I mean, you can see, I can see a scenario where somebody would great would rise up in the eyes of men and be able to sign a treaty between Israel and Hezbollah and Israel and the Palestinians, and, you know, fix the problems in the Sudan, fix the problems in Darfur, fix the problems in Indonesia, Malaysia, and, you know, India and Bangladesh, and all of that. There would be a huge world outcry for that person to be a leader of us. And I sort of see this first white horse in that mode. Comes out with a bow, which means he's got power, but he doesn't use it. He has no arrows. So he makes peace, makes the world a safe place. And that really is a direct parallel to the first year or so of the tribulation time. So you can't really put a name to all of these riders. But I think if this rider is not the Antichrist, he's certainly the power behind the Antichrist coming to power. So in any case, this is what I believe. He is the rider to come out to make the world a peaceful place. After everybody's gone, after the churches are raptured out, the chaos, he's to settle everything down, settle the wars, you know, heal some of the religious conflicts that are going on in the world. And he comes out and he conquers them in a bloodless manner. So you say, well, gosh, these aren't so bad so far. So then in verse 3, it says, when the Lamb opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature say, come. Then another horse came out, a fiery red one. Its rider was given power to take peace from the earth and to make men slay each other. To him was given a large sword. I want to talk about this for a minute. The red here is the symbol of blood and death and war. And so this red horse comes out, and its rider has been given the ability by God to take away the peace that was just created by the first rider. So the first rider comes out and creates this stable area of peace. The second rider comes out and can now take that peace away. And how does he take that peace away? What does he make happen to take that peace away? He makes people kill each other, okay? This is not necessarily war between major nations. This is brother against brother. This is father against son. This is neighbor against neighbor. This is people killing one another. And it's kind of an interesting thing. I want to look up two scriptures here, and I would like one of you, somebody to look up Isaiah 19:2, and somebody else to look up Zechariah 14:3. And I want you to understand that these predictions are not New Testament predictions. They're really affirmations of Old Testament. There's about a half a dozen others as well. Isaiah 19:2. Does somebody have that?
I will stir up Egyptians against Egyptians. Brother will fight against brother. Neighbor against neighbor. City against city. Kingdom against kingdom.
This is a discussion about the Lord's wrath, the Lord's judgment. So he's going to stir up brother against brother, countrymen against countrymen, cities against cities, you know, countries against countries. So he's going to stir up a hate that is inside of people. And let's look at Zechariah 14:3. Anybody have that one? Anybody find Zechariah?
Zechariah 14:3.
Okay, don't make me look this up now. 14:3.
Then the Lord will go forth and fight against those nations, as he fights in the city, fights in the day of battle.
Is that 14:3?
Yeah.
Okay, read 4.
And in that day his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, which faces Jerusalem on the east, and the Mount of Olives shall be split in two from east to west, making a very large valley. Half of the mountain shall move toward the north and half of it toward the south.
Okay. That really supports another verse that we've got in here, but I'll look up the correct verse. It's not 14:3 apparently. But in Zechariah, he's talking about a similar thing. Brothers against brothers, nations against nations, family against family. And that's all in the day of the Lord, all the time that he calls up. And so this is not a New Testament phenomenon. It's actually an Old Testament concern, an Old Testament prophecy of God as well, that he will do this. Now, he does it through the sword, which means the word for sword here is really the word for small sword, short sword. So where the archers shot from a distance, this is close in. This is like, a dagger. This is hand-to-hand combat, brother against brother, country against country, all of the things that are happening. And it's kind of a misnomer. Now, I don't expect any of you to have the book of Baruch here. The book of Baruch is one of the intertestamental books between the Old and New Testament. It's not part of our canon, but it is a good set of history. It's what the Catholics would call the Apocrypha books. But in Second Baruch, let me just read to you this verse, 40:37, it says, envy shall arise in those who had no thought of themselves, and passion shall arise in him who was at peace, and strong will shall be stirred up as anger. Can you read my own writing here? As anger to injure many, and they shall rouse up all men in order to shed blood, and in the end they shall all perish together. And so even in Baruch, now Baruch is part of these intertestamental writings, which really were the times between the Old and New Testament. You know, in the 400 years when the Old Testament ended before the New Testament began. And the very symbolic writings in here, and most of them were extensions to Old Testament books, and they weren't really canonized by the church. They never have been. But they're good history books because they were written by the Jews, you know, in this time of history. And so he's saying here that, you know, people will rise up and they'll kill each other, they'll kill one another, but in the end they'll end up killing themselves. Everybody will be killed. And I kind of liken this. We see some of this today, don't we? We see the politics of destruction in our own world today. It's not good enough to defeat someone's idea. You have to destroy them as a person. You know, you have to make them out as a person to be evil. We see it in politics. We see it in our cities. We see it everywhere today, where people are to gain their advantage, their personal hate, their personal enmity, personal politics of destruction begins to play out, and we begin to see it. Now, what we're seeing today, even as disgusting as it is in so many ways, is a pretty pale version of what we're going to see in this day and time, with people mad at one another. I mean, there's all kinds of, you read the newspapers every day, there's families, killing somebody else in the family, husbands and wives, children, mothers and fathers, aunts and uncles. There's all kinds of inner family squabbles that take place, and people resolve it by killing one another. Horrible, horrible thing, but it's part of our fallen nature. And so it's no different here. We begin to see, so we see the time of peace. Now we see the red horse come out who takes that time of peace, and he begins to turn people against one another. And you begin to see not killing from a distance, but real personal hate, real personal destruction. And then verse 5. Someone want to read 5 through 5 and 6 for me, please?
When the Lamb opened the third seal, I heard the third living creature.
Yeah, this is interesting. This one is pretty interesting. So we see a black horse coming forward, and its rider is holding a pair of scales. This is the black horse of famine. And, you know, it's universally true that when you have war of destruction, you have famine that goes along with it, because people are killed, lines of supply are cut. We see in places like Darfur, you hear talked about, where, you know, tribal warfare is taking place, and the innocent people